We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. This is the second hour of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for our show, Harriet Williamson, Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about a question that people have been thinking about, wrestling with for a long time, and that is, what is it that is more basic to human nature, violence or empathy? Now, there are some scientists who have studied some of our closest animal relatives, and they have drawn the conclusion that we are all killers by nature. However, our guest for this hour, primatologist Frans de Waal, offers a rather different answer based on his observation of some of our closest relatives. In some of his studies of monkeys and apes, he has seen animals exhibit behaviors that we would call caring and cooperation, raising the question, could it be that we are really hardwired for compassion? In this hour of the program, we'll talk with Frans de Waal about his work, what it suggests about human nature. He is a professor of psychology at Emory University and is director of the Living Links Center and has been studying primate behavior for a long time. He's the author of a number of books. His most recent look at the origin of human morality and the implications of what we know about particularly one species of animal that he's really become associated with, the bonobo, what we know about them and how they may suggest some models for human social evolution. His books include Good Natured, Bonobo, The Forgotten Ape, and most recent, The Age of Empathy, published by Harmony Books in 2009. He is visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll give a talk. This is part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative for this school year, 2010-2011, Knowing Animals, Histories, Strategies, and Frontiers in Human-Animal Relations. And I'm sure we'll have a number of people who are involved in this series here on the program. If you'd like to hear him, if you're in Champaign-Urbana, his talk will be this afternoon at 4. This is in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. These programs are free, open to the public. Anyone who would like to attend should stop by. And also here on this program, your input is welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. We do hope people will stay on the topic and try to keep their comments brief. But you can certainly call 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And you may also email will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here. It's a great pleasure.
I'm happy to be here.
To have you here. In the effort to try to answer this question about human nature, scientists have observed animals, and they have looked at some of our closest animal relatives. And, for example, the chimpanzee. And this is something that you, I think, you started out spending a lot of time at the time when you were in Europe, living in and working in Europe, looking at chimpanzees. And if you go back to particularly the maybe about 30 or so years ago and looked at what people were seeing and what they were saying, what would the story have been? What were people at that time saying that chimpanzees were telling us about ourselves?
At that time, everyone was interested in the question. We had this book out by Konrad Lorenz, a German, or an Austrian actually, and he had written this book on aggression, and everyone was studying aggression. And every discussion about human evolution was about how violent and how we were made to make war and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And the chimpanzee fit that model because the chimpanzee is a pretty aggressive animal, and they certainly between groups, they have sort of territorial warfare. And so everyone was very pleased that the chimpanzee fit that sort of image. And then in the 70s or so, the bonobo came along, which is exactly equally close to us as the chimpanzee, but is much less well known. And the bonobo is sort of primate hippie, you know, they're peaceful, the females are dominant, they have a lot of sex instead of that they fight. And a lot of anthropologists were unhappy with the bonobo because it didn't fit their thinking. But actually, I found it a relief to finally hit a close relative that was quite different from the chimpanzee. And I've been comparing them ever since. And I'm very interested in, let's say, empathy and peacemaking. And I must also say that the chimpanzee is actually quite good at that. The chimpanzee, this was overlooked in the chimpanzee, but the chimpanzee is actually quite a cooperative animal.
And that's, I guess it's probably important to say that that absolute pure types of one or the other, you know, you do see chimpanzees engaging in things we would call pro-social behavior. And I'm sure that you can see aggressive behavior in bonobos, too.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be careful about drawing a sharp, bright line.
That's the same is true for our species. So people will say, how can you call chimpanzees empathic if they sometimes kill each other? And then look at the human species. I mean, we certainly say that we have a capacity for empathy, but, you know, we often go to the neighbors and wipe them out. So that's our species here.
Yeah. So, and that's, I think, in fact, in some of our past conversations, I think, in talking about the difference between these two animals and then saying, well, what does that tell us about us? Well, I think one of the points you made was, well, I think we have to say when you're talking about humans, you have to say that we have the capacity for both of these kinds of behaviors.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can't really say, well, you know, are we one, are we the other?
And so it depends on the circumstances, what comes out. And so if you are living in an affluent society and there's no problems, then maybe the nice side comes out. But as soon as you get a depression in the economy, as we have now, there's a lot of nasty feelings that come out. Yeah. And I think the circumstances determine very much what comes out of an animal.
This, though, I think that one of the questions that I really wanted to have you talk about is if you look at the chimpanzees and the bonobos, they seem to have some fairly fundamental differences in their personalities.
Mm-hmm.
And here are now two animals that are about as close as any two animals can be.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to ask the question, well, given the fact that genetically they're very similar to the untrained eye, I'm sure they probably all look the same. So the question would be, well, why is it then that in these sort of basic behavior patterns that the bonobos and the chimpanzees are so different?
Yeah, you can get very big differences by very small changes. And so, you know, these experiments with humans where you put people in a room and they can play a game with each other and you spray oxytocin in their noses, which is a certain hormone, and before you know it, they become more trusting and more empathic. And so all you need in the bonobo is maybe a higher level of oxytocin or some other hormones that are increased and are decreased maybe in the chimpanzee, and before you know it, you have a major difference on your hands.
Mm. Does that have something to do with the fact that there seem to be – that the in groups of chimpanzees, you tend to have more males – Or I'm sorry, is it the other way they around? And then bonobos, maybe
let me explain how it is.
Yeah.
In the bonobos, the males are attached to their mother, so they travel with their mom. Mm-hmm. And if their mother is high ranking, these males will be high ranking. If the mother is low ranking, these males will be low ranking because the mothers defend their sons. And the males among themselves, they have very little relationship. And the males are physically stronger than the females, but the females collectively dominate the males. So that's the society. And sometimes human males, they say, oh, that's so sad that they're dominated by the females. But actually those males, bonobo males, live longer and I think a healthier life than chimpanzee males who are very violent. So chimpanzees live in a society where their mothers are also present. But the males have very little to do with their moms, and they form these political coalitions among themselves. And the males collectively dominate the females, and also they're physically stronger. And everything is decided basically among the males. Now, there's a lot of violence because chimpanzees also, they invade the territories of their neighbors and they kill their neighbors on occasion. And so the chimpanzee male actually has a very stressful life, in my opinion, compared to the bonobo male.
Yeah. This one of the things about this I think is really interesting is that there seemed to be, at least initially, I don't know if it's still the case, but it seemed initially that there was people were so strongly attached to the violent animal sort of model.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, the chimpanzee seemed for them to be an illustration of that, that they just couldn't accept the bonobo. It was something that was so, other than the fact that they were made uncomfortable by their randiness, it was something like they thought, well, this, something about this just can't be right because it just doesn't.
Well, that's the conflicted relation that we have with biology, basically, is that humans love to blame human biology for the bad things. So if we kill each other in Bosnia or wherever we kill each other, we say we're acting like animals. But as soon as we do something good, we like to claim that for ourselves, and we like to claim the noble characteristics that we have as something that we basically invented, either our religion or our culture or whatever. And my view is, of course, and that view I've held for a long time, is that both of these sets of capacities, the negative and the positive, they are biological, and so we share them with other primates.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of focus is Frans de Waal. He is director of the Living Links Center and professor of psychology at Emory University, and has been doing research on primates, some of our closest animal relatives, for a long time, taking a look at their behavior and asking some questions about what it is we might learn about humans and human nature by studying the behavior of these animals. And he's been particularly interested in asking questions about animals and whether or not they show things that we would call our maybe compassion, whether they show cooperation, whether there are animals that have what we might call a certain sense of fairness or equity. And he would say, based on his observations, the answer to all of those questions is yes. They have all of those.
So for example, for fairness, we did a funny little experiment a couple of years ago where we would put two monkeys. I also worked with capuchin monkeys. And we put two monkeys side by side who know each other. And you give them a very simple task, and you do it 25 times in a row. And you reward both of these monkeys with a small piece of cucumber. And both monkeys are perfectly happy, and they will do that, and there's no problem. But if you do the same experiment with the same two monkeys, and one of the two now gets grapes, the other one still gets just cucumber, the grapes are so much better. And so our question was, will they notice that the other guy is getting something better? And indeed they do. They start to object to the task. They throw the instruments that we use out of their cages. They throw the food. So these monkeys, they have cucumber, but normally every monkey would eat a piece of cucumber. They now throw them away, which is what the economists call an irrational response. And what they mean is that if you really want to optimize what you get, you need to take everything you can get. Mm-hmm. But the monkeys, just like humans do the same thing. They do these experiments with humans where you give humans differential rewards, and at some point people will refuse if you get less than somebody else. So our monkeys have, in that sense, a very primitive sense of fairness, in that they just like very young children, they don't like to get less than anybody else.
Yeah. It seems that all of these things that we're talking about, these things that we have labels for, things like compassion and empathy and fairness and all these things, that it at a certain level that animals, particularly primates and actually some other animals as well, they exhibit these behaviors. So from that, what conclusion do you draw?
Well, humans have a tendency, and I think this comes partly from our philosophers and people like that, is that they have a tendency to rate too highly this sort of stuff that we do. So, for example, you are sensitive to distribution of goods, and they will call that a sense of fairness, and a sense of fairness was invented during the French Revolution, they will say, you know. So they will give it a very high-level type of interpretation, but actually your sense of fairness probably relates to the feelings of small children when they get less than somebody else. And so they scale it in at too high a level, and then they're extremely surprised if dogs can do it or monkeys can do it or whales or whatever the animal is. But we in biology and also in neuroscience, we tend to take a bottom-up view. So we look at the basic building blocks of something, and they're usually very simple. And so I think the sense of fairness probably started with you being sensitive or animals being sensitive to differential reward distribution. And it's only much later that we started to worry about what is the effect of fairness on society as a whole or something like that.
Well, it's going back to the experiment that you described. I'm sure that there are some people that say, well, you did that in a laboratory. Mm-hmm. Those conditions wouldn't exist in nature. Would you see behaviors like that in nature if you were simply observing animals just encountering their environment?
Well, we do know that in nature, capuchin monkeys hunt, just like chimpanzees hunt. And so the chimpanzees hunt monkeys, and they surround monkeys, and then if several chimps do that, they have a much higher chance of capturing one. And the capuchin monkeys, they hunt squirrels, which is a very difficult task also. And so that's a situation where you have multiple cooperators, and you have only one reward, which is the animal that they're trying to capture, and it needs to be shared somehow. And so we think actually that inequity experiment that we do relates to natural behavior in that they face the situation where you invest in something and you want to get something out of it also. And so actually that's a theory that was developed for human sense of fairness by economists not so long ago, where they would say that if you are a cooperative animal, you need to be sensitive to reward distribution because you need to compare what you invest to what you get out of it. So it's basically an investment strategy type.
If you make the argument that the kind of behaviors that we're talking about are you can see them in animals, then I guess what you have to do is you have to get to the question, well, why? You know, why did those exist? And then I guess you have to get to the argument that says, well, there must be some advantage conferred by those behaviors, a survival advantage, and that would explain why it is that animals have them. They just didn't decide to do those things. They have to have a positive advantage.
That is a complex question because obviously we feel that all tendencies that evolved, they had some benefits. Otherwise, they wouldn't have evolved. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that each time we apply this behavior, we are aware of the benefits. So, for example, empathy evolved probably in the context of first maternal care and then other kinds of relationships in mammals, where it clearly had benefits. But now that we have the capacity, I can have empathy for a stranded whale, so to speak. Now, clearly my empathy did not evolve to take care of species other than my own, but I can apply it to species other than my own. And that's true for many of the capacities that we have. So a good example is sex, for example. Sex evolved for reproduction, but the reason we have the morning after pill is because people don't always think of reproduction when they have sex, because the sexual motivation has come sort of divorced from the consequences of the behavior. And so that's true for empathy also. Empathy clearly evolved in a context where it paid off, but now that we have it, we can apply it almost everywhere, and we try to apply it on a large scale nowadays.
Yeah. Well, give some other examples of research that would suggest or that would demonstrate that something that animals exhibit something that we would call empathy.
Yeah, so the first time I started working on empathy was actually I had discovered that chimpanzees console each other after fights. And so let's say one chimpanzee has lost a fight and is screaming, another will come over and kiss and embrace that individual and try to calm it down. And for a long time, I called it just consolation, a sort of neutral term. And then I attended a meeting by child psychologists who said, well, we're studying empathy in children. And the way we do that is we instruct family members to start crying and then we see what young children do. And the young children will approach them and will put their hands on them and will ask them how it's going. And that's what we call empathy. And I thought, well, that's exactly what I'm seeing in my chimpanzees. And if they call that empathy, I don't see why that could not be the same mechanism in chimpanzees. And so since that time, and of course now there are many studies, there are studies on dogs and mice and elephants. And so empathy is becoming a growth topic, basically, in the study of animals. But at the time, I was making that connection because the behavioral manifestation was exactly the same as what I was seeing.
Yeah. Well, that I'm sure gets into what is a sort of a controversial area because some people would say that, you know, even if you say you start out looking at humans and looking at the way we behave and what it is we think we know about human behavior and what the kind of behaviors people show and what we know about the inner states that are behind those behaviors. Mm-hmm. So we come to that, then studying, looking at animals with that kind of understanding, and we watch their behaviors, and we see them doing things that look exactly like human behavior. Mm-hmm. So there were some people that say, well, I mean, if it looks so much like that, we know what's going on. It would seem to be reasonable to assume that what's going on with them is the same thing that would be going on with us if we were showing those same behaviors. I'm sure at the same time there are other people that said, no, you can't do that because you can't really get into the animal's head and you really don't, just because it looks like empathy, unless we have some way to really figure out what's going on, we can't say that it is.
Well, I do believe that if you see this kind of behavior that looks similar to human behavior, let's say in a squirrel, or in a fish, or in a distant animal, you have to be careful, But if we get to chimpanzees, I'm a biologist, and I really think in a Darwinian manner. If you get to chimpanzees, they're so extremely close to us. Their brains don't have any parts that our brains don't have. That the most elegant assumption is really that if a chimpanzee does something very similar to humans under similar circumstances, like let's say they kiss and embrace after a fight, and I've called that reconciliation, and there's now lots of evidence that actually it functions as a reconciliation. And for empathy, there's also increasing this kind of evidence. Because the real Darwinian assumption is always that if two extremely related species do almost the same thing in almost the same circumstances, you're going to assume the same explanation for it.
Mm. Yeah. And what sort of benefit would that kind of behavior confer to this group?
I think empathy evolves in the context of maternal care, where it has very obvious advantages, yeah, because the female needs to be sensitive to the emotional state of her offspring. If her offspring are hungry, this applies to elephants and to mice equally, there's all mammals. She needs to respond to the hunger, the fear, or whatever the offspring has. And if she doesn't respond right away, she may lose her offspring. So there's a very high selection pressure, as we call it, on empathy. And then from there, it expanded to other areas. And that's actually why we still find that empathy is more developed in the female than the male, and why empathy responds to oxytocin, which is a female maternal hormone. And so there's lots of indications that it started probably with maternal care. But now, of course, men also have empathy, and it has spread to other areas of social life.
Mm-hmm. And it's all the explanation would be that somehow this is these kinds of things work to the benefit of the group as a whole,
mm-hmm,
and that confers an advantage, a sort of survival advantage for the, you know, by improving conditions for individuals within the group, it's good for the whole group.
So if you live in a group, you live in a group for a reason, like all the primates do and wolves do and elephants, you live in a group for a reason, meaning that you derive benefits from company. You derive benefits from others around you, which means that you need to care about them. If I live in a group and I depend on my buddies, I need to worry about their safety and their health. If they're going to die off, I'm going to die off. And so to show some empathy towards the individuals you depend on is in many ways a selfish strategy.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Frans de Waal. He is the director of the Living Links Center and is professor of psychology at Emory University. Was trained as a zoologist and ethologist in Europe and then came here to the United States. He was at Madison, and now he's at Emory and has been doing a lot of research over a number of years on apes and other monkeys, looking at things that we would call pro-social behavior. His most recent book is about empathy. It's titled The Age of Empathy. It was published in 2009, and he's done a lot of other writing about the kind of research that he's done looking at the behavior of some of our closest animal relatives and what that perhaps may have to tell us about human behavior and human nature. He's here on the campus to give a talk about this very thing. He'll be talking on the subject empathy in animals and humans. And he'll be giving this talk as part of an initiative of the Center for Advanced Study going on this spring or this fall and next spring, Knowing Animals, Histories, Strategies, and Frontiers in Human-Animal Relations. His talk is this afternoon at 4 at the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum on the campus. That's on South Gregory, and it's free and open to anybody who would like to stop by and hear him. We have a couple of callers here, and we welcome calls, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have several callers, and we'll take them in the order they came in and start with Champagne, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Interesting. I'd like to ask the professor to tell us more about oxytocin, sir. And is this a hormone only in females? Is it something that can be developed? Should we put it in the water like we do fluoride? You know, just if you would share your information about it.
Okay, well, oxytocin is a hormone that occurs in all mammals. And it's released, for example, during nursing. It is released during parturition, so when you give birth. And actually, when women have trouble giving birth, they give them some oxytocin sometimes to stimulate birth giving. And so it's per excellence a female hormone that's associated, but it, you know, it occurs also in males, and it's also stimulated, for example, by sexual activity. So it's often called a bonding or affiliation hormone that has generally positive effects if you spray it in the noses of people, which they just sometimes do in experimental settings. But I would not necessarily recommend it to put it in the water. You know, there have been people sort of joking about it, is that salespeople could use oxytocin. If you spray it in the noses of people who come, let's say, buy a car, you could more easily sell them a car, maybe, because they would become more trusting. But I think it's extremely tricky to start distributing this kind of hormones to everybody. So, but it is an interesting hormone, and people are increasingly studying now also the effects of it on the behavior of animals. But in humans, it has been pretty well tested now.
Is there any precursors to its development?
I don't know so much about it, because I'm really someone who works on the behavior side, not on the hormonal side.
Okay. Thank you. Very interesting program.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. We'll go to Savoy for our next caller here, line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Does the monkey that is getting the grapes ever realize that it's unfair?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because usually I call it an egocentric sense of fairness, is that only the one who gets less is worried about the process, and the one who gets more is not worried about the process at all. But now my collaborator Sarah Brosnan, who has been testing chimpanzees, and chimpanzees are apes and are quite different, on the same paradigm, she has found a few occasions where the one who gets more, so the one who gets the grape, doesn't accept the grape and refuses it until both of them get one. Now, that's, of course, very interesting. That goes much further than in the monkey study, because now we're getting really close to a sense of fairness that is not even to your own advantage. That's to the advantage of somebody else.
And that kind of sense varies enormously in the human population.
Oh, yeah. There's, of course, lots of humans who don't care about fairness. I know that, yeah.
All right, mm-hmm. Thanks. Just going back to that, you know, what you would think, as you said, you would think that for an animal, you don't turn down food.
Uh-huh.
That no matter what it is, you know, uh-huh. Maybe if the guy in the next cage is getting something better, you think, well, I have to eat, so I may not like it, uh-huh. but I'm going to take what I'm given. You would have to ask, well, for an animal to throw away food, at one level you say, well, that just doesn't. Makes sense.
Yeah, but if you live in a cooperative society, mm-hmm. where I invest and you invest, let's say we're two buddies, we go hunting together and we both work very hard to capture the prey, and you take 90% and you leave only some scraps for me. For me, then that's the decision: is do I want to work with you mm-hmm. next time? Do I want to go hunting with you? Maybe I don't. Maybe I have a better buddy that I can go with. And so I need to be sensitive to the reward distribution, and I may actually get mad at you. And that's, I think, what's happening with these monkeys. They become agitated, and they see that this as an arrangement that they don't like. You know.
Yeah. All right. Caller here in Indiana, Prairie Creek, Indiana, line four. Hello.
Hello. I understand that chimpanzees are equally left-handed and right-handed, which means their brains are left and right equally distributed dominance, whereas human beings, it's right-handedness depending on different societies, but anywhere from 10 to 20, only 10 to 20% are left-handed, so the rational left-hand side of the brain is dominant in human beings, mm-hmm. more so than the creative side of the brain. If you could talk about what researchers have found with this regard to this, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
So I recommend that you go on the internet and you type in the name Bill Hopkins or William Hopkins. He's a scientist at the Yerkes Primate Center who all his life has been working on what we call laterality. And he has found major differences. First of all, chimpanzees do have a right-hand preference. And second of all, their brains are asymmetrical, just as in humans. And so certain areas like the Wernicke areas are asymmetrical. And so there is laterality in a lot of animals, not just chimpanzees, actually. There's even, I believe, even in frogs they have found laterality recently. So there is an asymmetry, and also in chimpanzees there's a brain asymmetry.
Right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. To go back to the idea of empathy for a moment, one of the things I guess it's interesting is that it says something about the idea that animals, in the way that humans do, know who they are. Mm-hmm. Because I say the argument is that empathy depends on your having this understanding of who I am, that I'm an individual, that I have these feelings, that I'm a distinct person,
mm-hmm.
but that there are other persons that are like me that also have the same feelings and also have the same experiences. You know, the idea is, you know, if I hurt, well, I know what that feels like. And I know what it looks like. And if I see another person showing that same behavior, then I realize, well, yeah, they hurt too. And I know what that feels like.
You're talking about a pretty high level of empathy here. So mm-hmm. the basic empathy has multiple levels. Mm-hmm. The basic level is that I see you distressed and it makes me distressed.
And an automatic sympathetic sort of
so you fall and scrape your knee and I say ouch because it's almost as if it happens to me as parents do with their children all the time, and so that kind of emotion it's called emotional contagion, which we study yawn contagion in chimpanzees, how they yawn when they see others yawn, mm-hmm. which is related to that mm-hmm. whole phenomenon. Now that's the sort of empathy that we see in rodents and maybe in dogs. The empathy that you're talking about, where you take the perspective of somebody else, where you imagine how it is to feel in a particular situation, that requires a lot more brain power. And I do believe apes have that, and dolphins and elephants. And we study self-awareness, so to speak, in elephants. And there's lots of stories on that. So let me tell you one story.
Yeah.
In chimpanzees, a case at a zoo in Sweden, where a juvenile chimpanzee was choking to death. It was hanging in ropes, and the ropes were around its neck, and it was basically dying. And no one could interfere because you cannot just step in with chimpanzees and try to do something. But the alpha male of the group, the highest-ranking male, he came over, and he lifted with one arm, he lifted up the juvenile, and with his free hand, he then carefully unwrapped the rope, and then he put the juvenile down on the ground, which is a very smart response because the impulsive thing would be to start pulling at the juvenile or start pulling at the rope, and which would be a sure way of killing it. So he did the smart thing, which to me requires that he understood the situation, in specifically the situation of this juvenile, which gets to this perspective taking. Mm. And I think chimps have that capacity, and we have evidence for elephants and dolphins too. But very few animals do. And of course, humans have it, but humans have it only after the age of 2 or maybe 4, according to some people. And so it's something that develops slowly. And that's the higher level of empathy, where you take the perspective of somebody else, and not all animals are going to have that.
Yeah. Well, that's what's so fascinating about it is, as you say, that's something that humans have, but it's something that comes at a certain stage of, mm-hmm. of development. They're not born with it. Mm-hmm. And maybe it has something to do with when the point comes when the individual understands he or she is a distinct individual.
Yeah, in the child, it appears at the same age that they start to recognize themselves in the mirror. And that's why we tested mirror self-recognition in elephants, because we assumed if elephants are so empathic and so altruistic, they should be recognizing themselves in the mirror too. And so that's why we tested an elephant. And today, this afternoon, I will be showing some videos of that.
And this is this kind of thing where you can take something and put a smudge on them, and then they go up to the mirror and they look and they realize it's them, and because they try to wipe it off.
Yeah, and so they have a mark on themselves that they cannot see without the mirror. That's the big trick. And that's a critical part of the trick, yeah.
And I guess that you can do that same thing with kids, that you can put a smudge on their nose, and at a certain point they're not going to but the point
kids,
will come when
kids
they
pass that test at 18
look at
months.
Themselves and think, what is that? And they try to rub it
so
off.
So for kids, it's between 18 months and 2 years. And at about 2 years, they start to show these more complex forms of empathy also.
Yeah. So you think that there is evidence to believe that this ability to put yourself in the place of the other, that chimpanzees at least, yeah, are the most advanced primates, the ones that are closest to us, that they have that ability.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
One of the things that's difficult perhaps to explain is, in humans, maybe in other animals too, is how it is that you can essentially see both those behaviors, and how it is that you feel one way to your family, you feel another way to your group, but a certain point comes when, even though it's the same species, mm-hmm, there's some kind of difference there, and that's where we get into these problems of us, yeah, and them.
Well, that's an interesting thing of empathy, is that it's biased towards the in-group, and that has already been found in a mouse study, is that mice are sensitive to the pain of others, but only others that they know. They're not sensitive to the pain of strangers. And so I think this is going to be found in all the studies probably of empathy, certainly in human studies has been found, is that we have a lot more empathy for individuals that are close to us than individuals that are distant, and much more for the in-group than the out-group. And so in human society, where we now live in these very large-scale societies where there's a lot of groups, that's the big challenge of the present society, is to extend that empathy beyond your own little family circle, and to extend it not only to your own country, but maybe even beyond your own country, and that we're trying to do that. So empathy has that bias. And I'm fascinated by in my book I write about the dark side of empathy, is because the other side is that we can go to a place where we don't know anybody and we kill them off. So we can apparently turn off empathy completely under certain circumstances. And I'm puzzled by that kind of thing. So, and for example, I'm very interested in PTSD. Soldiers go to places where they're only strangers. They're instructed to kill those strangers. They do the killing, but they come back and they have a lifelong trauma. Now, that's very interesting to me, because it means that probably they're not completely turning off the empathy. They're ordered to do this stuff, but they're not capable of 100% turning down the empathy. Mm-hmm. And maybe some people can, like psychopaths can. And actually, there's a book on warfare that claims that 90% of the killing is done by less than 5% of the military.
Yes.
Which I find a very interesting finding, because it could be that most of the killing is just done by those people who don't have empathy.
Yes, and one of the challenges that the military has faced over time is what they have said is there something that we can do in our training to get that number up higher, to get more people who would be willing to press the trigger?
Although, yeah, I take it as a sign of hope, is that humans cannot completely turn down their empathy,
yeah,
which I think is a good thing in a way.
Yeah. Well, that you can, I guess that you can understand, you talked earlier about if you're an animal that lives in a group, mm-hmm, that there are advantages for the individuals in the group's success and in the group working together, people all working together for a common goal, and then you'd hope that people are all sharing in the result. Mm-hmm. So you, mm-hmm, can see good reasons, for people behaving with empathy toward their group.
Oh, sure, sure.
But that the problem is that the guys over the hill, mm-hmm, your group is competing over, mm-hmm, whatever, mm-hmm, resources there are with the, yeah, other group. So you can see why there would be a completely different set of rules about,
yeah,
the other
people. No, for the biologist, there's nothing more logical than that you are biased towards your own group. That, for, mm-hmm, us, that's a logical finding. But of course, as I say, we now live in societies, and we live in a global community, so to speak, where we're trying to foster relationships with people in far corners of the world. And so we probably need to get over some of that xenophobia that we have.
We have about 10 minutes in this part of the show. I have a call I'll get right to. But again, let me introduce the guest, Franz De Waal. He's a professor of psychology at Emory University, is director of the Living Links Center. He's also involved with the Yerkes National Primate Research Center that is also in Atlanta, and has been studying primate behavior for a long time, looking at their behaviors and what it is perhaps we can learn about humans and human behavior by studying animals and animal behavior. He's written a lot about this. His most recent book is The Age of Empathy. It was published by Harmony Books just last year and has a number of others out that I'm sure you can find. If you want to read some of his work, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hi. Uh-huh. I'd like to pick up on what you just said. You were talking about PTSD among American soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And I was wondering, and so there's been studies about that. I wonder if there's ever been any studies on empathy in the other direction. In other words, is there PTSD among Al-Qaeda or Taliban? Now, I don't know whether anyone's done any studies on that or whether there's ideological issues which are so strong that it cancels out the empathic or PTSD triggers. And I wonder if this has been done, if we go back to, let's say, the Vietnamese War and look at the difference between PTSD of American soldiers versus PTSD of Vietnamese, or if we go back to World War II and we talk about PTSD among concentration camp guards or PTSD among Japanese soldiers. So I was wondering if that's what came up, and I'll listen on
okay.
there.
Okay. Well,
let me first of all say that I think that requires a distinction whether you are the invader or the recipient of an invasion. So if Americans would be defending their country against an invasion from wherever, I'm not sure you would have the same trauma, because defending your own piece of land against others is something else than going to a place like Americans going to Iraq and killing people at a distant place. I think that is a very different experience. We do know that PTSD, at least an equivalent of it, was known already to the Greeks, and that the Greeks have plays, and actually the Veteran Administration is using those plays to deal with PTSD, that there are Greek plays on how soldiers would come back from the front and commit suicide or be completely depressed. And so it is a phenomenon that has been known for a long time. But if you want to compare, let's say, Al-Qaeda with American soldiers, I think you need to make the distinction whether you're defending your own place or whether you're invading somebody else's place. I think that probably has an effect on how much trauma you get.
All right. Quickly, we have about 5-6 minutes left. We have, I think, actually another caller here. I was going to say, if someone wants to call very quickly, we can get him in. Another Champaign person here, line one, right here. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
I have a question for the guest, and I just finished reading a book review of a biography of George Price.
Yeah.
And I was wondering whether you ever used game theory
mm-hmm.
in any of your studies in regard to the, say, the genetic predisposition for empathy. And then you mentioned that you in your studies, you discovered that empathy seems to be stronger in genetically related groups.
Mm-hmm.
And can you comment on that?
Yeah, so the book of George Price, it's called The Price of Altruism. It's actually a very interesting book because it's a review since Kropotkin and Darwin of what everyone has thought about altruism. Now the thing is that's the genetic level. That's actually the level of how altruistic behavior and empathy is included in that might have evolved, and not just in mammals, but also in social insects and so on. My own work is much more on what we in biology call the mechanism, is how does it work? How does one individual get to act on behalf of another individual? And so it's not so much about the evolution where these game prisoners' dilemma and so on, these games are very relevant. And so for my work, that's not particularly relevant because I want to know how the stuff works in daily life.
I see. Okay, well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. And another Champaign caller here, line two. Hello.
Hello. Yes. I missed a lot of the show, so I may have missed this discussion already, but I noticed you were talking about PTSD in reference to implying that it was caused by people having engaged in the act of killing, whereas most of the discussions I've heard of PTSD seem to discuss the effect of the threat of being killed, you know, being in combat and being worried from being shot by snipers or being blown up or whatever. I was wondering if you could discuss that. and I'll listen off air. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's probably a different. That's where you have intense fear, so to speak, and these fears can be revived, and that's what PTSD is also about. But I'm specifically referring to a book that was written by a U.S. Lieutenant. Grossman, which is called
On Killing.
Yeah, that's what it is. And it's about how people have a lot of trouble killing, and that how the military has a lot of trouble getting. And I just recently heard this funny story, which I have not really checked upon, but that even in Las Vegas, they control the drones, I believe, that fly there in Afghanistan. That even those people who control the drones and are very far removed from the actual battlefield, they have sometimes PTSD. So they have been killing from a distance, and they may see that on their TV screen, that's possible, but they are traumatized by what they're doing. Yeah. And so I'm very interested. Yes, I know that there's also the intense fear issue, which is a different issue, I think, than this particular one.
There's also an interesting book. It's been out a number of years, and I don't recall the author of the book, but he's a psychologist who's written about PTSD, and which, of course, has been called very many different things. It's a book that's called Achilles in Vietnam. Uh-huh. And it looks at the story of the Trojan War.
Yeah, yeah.
And indeed tries to make this point that probably something like PTSD, whatever it was called, as long as humans have been in war, people have experienced it.
So that means to me that because people often say warfare is in our DNA, we are made to wage war. That cannot be entirely true, because if we were made to wage war, we would do it with pleasure. We would have a lot of happiness doing it, like we have with sex and eating, which is really what we're made to. And so the fact that we come back traumatized means that we have trouble with warfare, I think.
Well, you know, human thinkers of various kinds, probably for a long time, have been engaged in this exercise, trying to think about what they can find. Can they find something that makes humans different from other animals?
Sure.
And things over time have been proposed. And as we spend more and more time watching animals, each of those things ends up seemingly getting knocked aside. So as soon as we come up with something, eventually a point comes we say, well, no, actually. So where are we, do you think, with that quest to find what makes humans different from other animals?
Well, that has surely been the history that I've, there's a long history of making claims about humans and how special we are. Yeah. That have been knocked away. And as soon as one of them disappears, let's say only humans have theory of mind or only humans have deception or whatever the claim is, very soon after we knock it out as scientists, there's going to be another claim, immediately following a new claim. And they usually don't last longer than 5 years or 10 years nowadays. And the only claim that for me still stands is that we have language. And even though you can teach apes some rudiments of language, you can teach them some aspects of it, they don't have a discussion like we do at this moment. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that remains the difference. And all the rest, I think, is minor. And certainly in terms of our social psychology, the way we interact and our emotions, I think we are very similar to the apes.
Yeah. All right. We'll try to get real quick one more caller here. Thomas Burrow, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I mean, when we look at the PTSD, I think the three functions of fog of war, then the other two things that are coming in, like his thoughts on it, is all the neurotoxicity. And then the third function is the ethical and moral dilemmas, where we've all been sent into these wars since Vietnam, where we're told they pose such a threat, and yet there's no enemy that really poses any threat to us, and how that affects the PTSD.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I mentioned, is that it's probably different for when you go to a place where you don't belong, in a way, and wage war, compared to defending your own country. So if someone were to invite America, to invade America, and you would be defending your country, and do a lot of atrocities in the process, I'm not sure that you would have been so traumatized by it, because morally, that's what this caller is saying. It would be a very different issue for you.
Yeah. We're coming down to maybe about a minute or two. At the end, I'm sure that there's much more that can be learned. You and other people, I'm sure, will be continuing to look at these things. But I think the question is, well, truly, if we look at behaviors in animals, what it is we can learn about us, about mm-hmm. human beings, by doing that.
Well, I think in this particular case of empathy, what I'm showing, and that's why my book is partly called The Age of Empathy, is that it's a much older characteristic than we assume. So there's often this assumption that we invented empathy or that we're the only ones who have it. But if you can show that it's a very old characteristic, that is as old as the mammals probably, then I think it becomes a much more deeply rooted characteristic. In a way, I see it as an optimistic view in the sense that it makes something that cannot be easily removed from our species because we are born with it, basically.
Yeah. Well, at this point, I think we have to finish it, but I can promise to people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana that if you would like to hear more from Francois, he'll be giving a talk this afternoon on the campus. This is part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative for 2010-2011, Knowing Animals. And if you want to find out more about that or about the center, you can go to their website. That's very easy. And you can just stop by this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on the campus on South Gregory in Urbana. That's free and open to the public. Pro-social primates, empathy in animals and humans. Franz Duval will be speaking. He's professor of psychology at Emory University at Atlanta. Also is associated with the Yerkes National Primate Research Center there. And maybe if you'd like to read some of his work, you might look at his most recent book, which is The Age of Empathy, published by Harmony Books just last year. Well, thank you very much.
Well, it was a pleasure.